Good morning and welcome. Welcome to Matt Nair on Air. Jane Matt Nair, Greg Bach, Calvin Butenhoff coming to you live from our studio in sunny downtown Waukesha. No matter where you're listening to Civic Media, you can always call or text at 855-75-CIVIC. That's 855-752-4842. Leave a comment on the live stream on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. Just a reminder, also, if you ever have a suggestion, a guest you would like us to have on the show, you can email that to Jane Says, J-A-N-E-S-A-Y-S, Jane Says at civicmedia.us. Very happy to have our next guest with us. I think this is appearance number three. David Drake is a professor and extension wildlife specialist at UW-Madison. David, we are here today to talk about elk.
Are you serious?
I had Calvin find that just for you.
That's what an elk sounds like?
David, we can't hear you. Oh, there you are.
All right, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yes, I should say that was not me bugling. That's not how I sound. That's how a male elk sounds. But nice to have be back on the show with you, Jane. Thanks for the invite.
Absolutely. It's always great to have you here. And I saw this article that we're bringing back elk hunting. I was unaware that there was much of an elk population in Wisconsin, but I'm assuming, like so many places, that was just something that was indigenous to the area, and then we wiped them all out at one point.
Yeah, so elk are a native species to Wisconsin. It was thought that initially, there's a bunch of different subspecies of elk, but it was initially thought that historically the elk were from the eastern elk species, which has gone extinct now. So the subspecies that are here is the Rocky Mountain elk. But they belong in the landscape. They've been here, historically. And the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, along with many, many different partners, including some of the native tribes in the state, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, individuals have worked extremely hard to reintroduce elk in two different areas of Wisconsin. So in 1995, they started a reintroduced population of elk in the Clam Lake region, which is up in the Suquamish and Nicolet National Forest in northern Wisconsin, kind of northwestern part of the state. And that kind of started taking some traction, and the population over time started to grow. And in 1995, that was a Wisconsin State Legislature mandated initiative. There was a great interest in elk for a whole variety of reasons, because they're a majestic animal. If you are a hunter, people like to, people spend thousands of dollars to leave Wisconsin to go out west and hunt elk in the fall each year. So there's a lot of interest in that, but there's a lot of people who just like elk because they're such a large animal. And that bugling that you just played at the beginning of the show, that really resonates with people. There's something that just kind of touches people's wild nature inside of them with that, whether you hunt or not. And so there's a lot of interest in that. And because the Clam Lake herd was growing, the Wisconsin State Legislature, along with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and again a host of partners, reintroduced a second elk population in Jackson County in the Central Forest region all around Black River Falls. And so there's two distinct populations in the state. They don't interact with each other because there's too much distance between them.
Sure.
But ultimately, hopefully, we'd have one sustained population throughout the entire state.
As you said, they started the herd in Clam Lake in 1995. So this takes decades.
It does. Yeah, absolutely. It takes a while to figure out how to reintroduce populations. And again, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is not unique in doing this. Other state agencies and our federal agency, the Fish and Wildlife Service, does this with a whole host of wildlife species to kind of bring populations back, to sustain populations that might be lagging, to try to prevent or avoid extinction, endangerment, threatened species status, things like that. So, but yes, it does take a while because essentially you're engineering nature.
Yeah. Hey, girl, go.
Get over there.
Go on a date. Go on, right? Go on a date.
I have someone, go on a date. I have someone perfect for you.
This is when you cue Marvin Gaye.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Exactly. So, let's get
what's going on. What is going on here?
David Drake is our guest. He's a professor and an extension wildlife specialist at UW-Madison. And we're talking about the fact that for the first time, we're going to have an elk hunt in Wisconsin. So for people who are hunters, they've got to be very excited about this.
Let me just correct that. So sure. This is the first time we're going to have an elk hunt in the central forest region, the central forest population. Elk hunting has been going on in the state since 2018 with that reintroduced population in Clam Lake. But this is the first time where they're going to have an elk hunt in the central forest region. So they'll have an elk hunt in both populations right now, starting in 2024.
And maybe you, because this is a lot, it's kind of a dense information topic here. But like, yeah, why reintroduce them then to allow to hunt? Like, if they weren't, if we were reintroducing them, why are we allowing hunting? Especially, I mean, in 2018, that's not long ago. And I've never heard of like the rampant overpopulation. Because like one of the reasons why we hunt deer is because of overpopulation. And that makes sense to a lot of people. But to me, I'm like, well, if we reintroduce them, why are we hunting them now?
Yeah, it does not make sense to people who may not have grown up in the culture of hunting and things like that. But yes, you're right. Why work so hard to reintroduce the species than to just harvest the species? But the species is being harvested. These elk hunts are done very scientifically. They're done according to strict management and regulations, and they're done in a sustained manner. So, for example, they haven't released how many bull elk tags will be taken for this year, or bull elk tags will be issued for this year. But it probably is not going to be more than 10.
That.
There's about 515 total elk is the most recent estimate. There's about a 515 total elk across both populations in the state. And so very few elk are going to be taken, and only bull elk, only the males are going to be taken, because if you take a female, that has a impact on the reproduction and recruitment into the population. So you take the bull elk, that doesn't impact the growth of the population like a female elk would. But the other issue is one of the group's partners here is Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, and that's a very strong advocacy group. That's a elk hunting group, but they're also elk conservation and management. And what happens when you get strong advocacy for a species, typically you have money that gets poured into that species. So you have a lot of interest to grow that population. And if you look at this, species that have advocacy groups for them, and it could be Whitetails Unlimited, Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, you know, Ruffed Grouse Society. It doesn't matter. All these populations tend to do pretty well because there's so much interest and so much money that's being dedicated to it. It's the species that are on the endangered species list where we need, you know, friends of groups and advocacy groups.
Yeah.
That would really boost those populations simply because you'd highlight and market them and you'd fund them properly.
I would think, too, that it's important, especially when you're allowing the hunting of the bulls, just for genetic variations. Because, is there a predominant male who is, you know, who's the one who gets lucky all the time? And
Steve.
And his name is Steve.
Yeah, it does help with that. And, you know, the other issue is they're trying to manage the population within the balance of the environment. And that Clam Lake herd, as it grows, and same for the Central Forest herd as that grows, you know, they're starting to see some elk damage occasionally, where elk are starting to move into agricultural areas and causing agricultural damage. For example, there are elk that are colliding with vehicles, which, you know, hitting a deer is bad enough.
Oh,
hitting
man.
Is times 10.
I can't even imagine hitting an elk.
What is the average size of an elk? A bull?
I don't know. I'd have to look that up offhand.
Greg is doing it.
It's bigger than Greg, I'll tell you that.
Did you just call me skinny? No.
Black looks good on you, Greg.
A bull elk averages 5 feet tall at the shoulders and can weigh up to 700 to 1,100 pounds.
Yeah, so they're big animals.
Oh,
wow. And, you know, something that large, if they're in your agricultural field, they're eating a lot as well. And so this is a balancing act to allow people to continue to be interested in this population from a hunting standpoint, because there are a lot of people who do hunt elk. It's also trying to balance kind of the societal goods and bad. So having the elk population, restoring a native population, but also balancing that against agricultural damage, vehicle damage, things of that nature.
Well, I imagine, so going back to the hunting aspect, as you were talking about, when deer hunting happens, there's policing and patrolling and rules that are enforced. You're only allowed so many. Mm-hmm. And with so many deer out there, I have to imagine if you said that if only 10 tags maybe are going to be given out, that's going to be basically like a lottery. There'll be a line at the door to register for, like, and the policing of people trying to hunt elk at that point legally is going to be very difficult because so few tags are out there and people are like, well, I'm just going to go out and hunt. What do I need a tag for? You know what I mean? Like,
well, that's one of the things about a high profile species like elk though, is when a relatively nascent hunt like this starts, there's so much attention on it. And if you are one of the tag holders, one of the lucky tag holders, if somebody it's kind of like cheating, right? If you're doing all the right things and you see somebody cheat, you have an incentive to report that cheater.
Yeah.
And because there's so much attention on the elk hunt, it would be extremely rare for somebody to break the rules and not be found out. But also, the wildlife conservation wardens and things like that will be vigilant during the elk hunt and make sure that no illegal activity or unregulated activity is occurring.
The 2024 seasons are going to happen from October 12th to November 10th. And then again, from December 12th through the 20th.
That's my birthday, December 12th.
You want to? We'll get you a tag.
No,
if you want.
No. Let better hunters. Let hunters do
let
that.
Let hunters do that.
And we should say also, though, yeah, thanks for mentioning the dates. We should also say the elk application period is now, it's open now from April 10th till May 31st. So if you are interested in trying to get a tag, make sure that you go and apply through the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources website.
We will get all of the information in our show notes. If you ever have questions, we include the links to all of the articles. So you can go to civicmedia.us, click on Matt Nair on Air, and that will take you to everything you need. David, can you stay with us for another segment?
Sure.
Great. I have a question that might annoy the Elk Defamation League, so we'll find out how far I'm going to push it. Stay with us. You're listening to Matt Nair on Air, coming to you across the Civic Media Radio Network.
Swing man, she can't hurt. She don't mean no harm. She just don't know what else to do about it. James,
good morning and welcome back to Matt Nair on Air. Jane Matt Nair, Greg Buck, Sweet Cal B on the board. You can always join us. Call or text at 855-75-CIVIC. Leave a comment on the live stream on Facebook, YouTube, or the platform that Elon continues to ruin. We are talking to David Drake, professor and extension wildlife specialist at UW-Madison, and we are talking about elk season happening October 12th to November 10th, and again from December 12th through the 20th.
That sound will haunt my nightmares.
Okay, here's what I'm going to say that's going to annoy elk people. That's like the Mike Tyson of voices. When you look at an animal as big as an elk and it's 700 to 1,000 pounds and that's the call, I think that's hilarious.
Do you say that now and you are standing face to snout with an elk? You don't really care about what noise is going. It could start singing songs from Taylor Swift's new record. I'm still going to be whizzing in my jeans, afraid for my life.
Yeah, if you want to see the power of elk, all you need to do is Google videos of elk and people in Banff, Canada.
Oh, really?
In the town of Banff. So elk come into the town of Banff and people do not give them proper space. And elk are extremely powerful animals. And like Greg said, it doesn't matter what they sound like. When you see something like that charged at you, it gets your attention.
It's just when you look at an animal like that, and I'm expecting this big, beefy, ooh, and it's like, yeah, wee.
I feel like you're just tempting fate.
Send your complaints to Calvin. You want an Elk Defamation League, and you call Calvin. Talk to Calvin. I don't want to hear about it.
It That's why they call it bugling, for one thing. But also, if you have ever heard them out in the wild, you can hear them from a distance. And especially when there's multiple elk bugling back and forth, it is just a absolute beautiful symphony.
It's got to be surreal. It really must be. Mike from Newburgh is on the line. Good morning, Mike. Thank you so much for joining us. What do you want to say?
Well, I enjoy your program, and I think conservation is so important in the state. I hope you guys continue having programs like this. I wanted to let the professor know that in 2022, across from my land in Vernon County, now I've hunted elk when I was a young man. I'm in my 70s now. There stood a bull elk behind my friend Edith's farm up on the hill, and I didn't bugle. I watched them with my binoculars, and I called the DNR, and oh my gosh, they were excited, and they think it came all the way down from the Jackson herd at that time, just roaming around, and it didn't have a tag on it because they asked me about it, or a collar, and it was just beautiful to watch him up on that high hill, and I don't know whatever happened to him, but I hope he got back to Jackson County, but that was pretty cool, and they do move around a lot. And I think it's so important. I hunted elk when I was a young man. I bull hunted. I was very particular and very close. I think the closest elk I shot was about 9 steps. A lot of respect for the animal. But I hope for the grandkids and the future, we keep our conservation programs like this very strong. Mm-hmm. And I donate to these programs all the time.
Thank you so much, Mike. Really appreciate it. Thank you so very much for listening. And we agree with you. And that's why we love to talk to people like David and talk to other things about it's our natural resources and how important it is that we protect our natural resources. And Earth Day is coming up Monday, and we're going to be talking to someone about PFAS in our water. And I am curious about the effect of PFAS in the water for our animal populations, because if we're drinking it, they're drinking it.
Yeah.
So that's an entirely different thing. But that must make you happy, David, to hear that there are a lot of people who we love Wisconsin. We love the things we have in Wisconsin, and we want to protect them.
Yeah, absolutely. Wisconsin and the residents of Wisconsin are very educated about natural resources, care deeply about natural resources, and it's great that the populace does, because that is absolutely needed. I'll just second what Mike said. I wasn't familiar with that story of an elk being in Vernon County, but this past fall, there was an elk that came down likely from the Jackson herd into McFarland, which is in Dane County here, just south of Madison. And it was seen on a main street in McFarland, and it continued to move south. And unfortunately, that one got hit and killed by a semi truck in Illinois.
I remember that. Oh. Yeah.
But they will move around for sure. And, you know, even though they're reintroduced in the Jackson County area or Clam Lake County, doesn't mean they stay there.
There's always one elk who's just got to go off and do his own elk thing,
Jane,
whatever.
You're just picking fights with the elk, and they're going to remember you. I'd like to hear wild bugling through the forest as you're trying to find safety.
I would be the biggest coward in the world, and I think we can all agree on it.
I would look over your shoulder, Jane, as you walk through the woods.
Mark from the SAC is on the line. Good morning, Mark. I bet you have a good elk story.
Well, I can remember hunting out in backcountry out in North Dakota and hearing the elk bugling away, and I don't know, and they're probably a good distance away because that sound carries for a long ways, that high-pitched elk bugle. But I was wondering that when there was predominantly a lot of elk in Wisconsin, I mean, Wisconsin was not just forest from the Illinois border up to Lake Superior. I mean, my understanding is that probably prior to the mid 18th century, that some of the Indian tribes had actually moved out of Wisconsin because of, you know, that various pressures, that apparently disease wiped out a number of Native American tribes when it came up, you know, via the European contact, and that the practice of, you know, burning off the forest to create, you know, prairie for farming and for hunting, that I think it's my understanding the prairie virtually reached up the shores of Lake Superior, probably in terms of some kind of scrub oak savanna. And then when the tribes had moved away for a while, that the forest came back. And that wasn't, you know, not, you know, thousands of years of old growth. There was probably just a couple hundred years of old growth on the shores of Lake Superior. You know, and I know that because my grandparents actually lived on Lake Superior, moved up there during the Depression. And some trees had come back at that point in time.
Mark, we're running right up against the clock. Thank you so very, very much, Mark from Prairie du Sec. Always appreciate you calling and always appreciate you listening very, very much.
I should just say one thing about what Mark was just talking about. The elk are very important to certain native tribes in the United States. And the Ojibwe tribe has, because of their ceded territory, they have a negotiated agreement with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and actually the state of Wisconsin. So whatever elk tags are issued, they get half of that harvest that is dedicated to the northern herd, the Clam Lake herd, not to the Jackson County herd. But that is a really interesting dynamic as well about the relationship between the elk and native tribes and native tribes now having authority over natural resources that belong to them.
Have you tasted elk, David? Is it tasty?
Oh, it's delicious.
Is it?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
I have like 1,000 jokes right now, and none of them are, we don't have time.
David Drake, it is always such a pleasure to have you here. He's a professor and extension wildlife specialist at UW-Madison. Thank you so very much, David. Take care.
Bye. Have a good day.
You
Bye.
As well. Stay with us. News is next, and then we recombobulate with Dan Schaefer. You're listening to Matt Nair on Air. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Morning. Welcome back to Matt Nair on Air. Jane Matt Nair, Greg Bach, RYPC on the board, coming to you from our studio. Resident young person.
Oh, Calvin. Yes. Oh, thank you.
From our studio in downtown Waukesha, you can always join the show at 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. Leave a comment on the live stream on Facebook, YouTube, and what used to be Twitter. He does join us every Friday. Had to move things around a little bit, no problem. Dan Schaefer is here from the recombobulation area. Good morning, Dan. How you doing?
Good morning, everybody. I'm doing well. Happy to be here on Matt and Aaron Air with you to recombobulate on a Friday.
So you just wrote about the recent findings from the Marquette University Law School poll.
Yeah, that's right. So every this is one of the things that I've done since I started the recombobulation area is every new Marquette University Law School poll, I will dig into the crosstabs and break down the results and provide some of the in-depth analysis that you come to expect from the recombobulation area. So it was a pretty interesting poll overall. Lots we could jump into, but I think overall, I think this is a pretty good poll for Republicans. You know, Trump with a little bit of a lead in the head-to-head poll against Biden. And then for Eric Hovde, for the first poll that he was in the race for, polling close to Tammy Baldwin among, pretty much even among likely voters, an edge for Baldwin, a 5-point edge for Baldwin among registered voters. I talked with Charles Franklin, the poll director at the Marquette University Law School poll. He said the registered voters is the more reliable metric at this stage of the race. It will shift to be likely voters as the more reliable one once we get closer to the election and we have a better idea of how likely that vote will be. But I think, just going into this, I think there's a number of things that people were on Democratic side were hoping to see, maybe Biden open up a little bit of a lead. I think nationally his polling has been a little bit better since the State of the Union. But in Wisconsin, his approval rating continues to be low. But I think, overall, it's a good poll for Republicans. We're going to have good polls for Republicans and good polls for Democrats over the course of this, over the next, 6-7 months here before Election Day. So if, a 2-point advantage and being close to Baldwin is a good poll for Republicans, Maybe on balance, this still projects to be a Democratic year, but we know this is Wisconsin. We know it's going to be a toss-up. We know everything's going to be close. So I think some of the more interesting stuff from this poll in particular is in those crosstabs, is in the details, is in, you know, some of the issue polling as we get further into the breakdown.
Well, and as you mentioned, Dan, we still have a long way to go. There's a lot of things that can happen before November. We have a very long way to go. What I was surprised by, and I guess I shouldn't, because we've talked about this before, because of our jobs, we read many things and follow many things, and we're much deeper into this stuff than the average person is, because they have lives and they have children and they have grandchildren and they, you know, whatever. But there is an immense lack, I would say, of even knowing who the candidates are and what they stand for, right? I'm stunned that anyone cannot have an opinion on X, whichever candidate it is. I don't know enough yet. Really?
Yeah, that is always baffles me too. And, you know, and it's just we're in it, right? We're, you know, our jobs bring us close to this. So we're paying attention to things very closely. And it always startles a lot of people who are in it when you show them their poll results, like Robin Voss's favorability rating, where he has, you know, still after being the longest serving assembly speaker in state history, you have close to half of voters, not just half of people, but half of voters saying that they don't yet have an opinion on Robin Voss. And you know, I think I talked about this a lot when I was writing about Ron Johnson in the run up to his reelection. You know, years before he ran for that third term, he was kind of unknown by close to 30% of voters in a lot of this, of voters, not just of the population.
People, right.
Again, it's of voters. So I, you know, and again, now we're seeing that with Tammy Baldwin. I think her number of people who did not yet have an opinion of her was around 20%. Now it's a little bit, now that we're having, you know, now that we're into the campaign season, that tends to narrow, but now still, you know, you have 11% of people don't have an opinion of somebody who's running for their third term as a U.S. Senator. It is a baffling thing. But I think one thing that I thought was interesting, at least within that, this, you know, haven't heard enough type of metric was, you know, more than half of voters have not yet heard enough about Eric Hovde to have an opinion of him. And I looked through the data to compare it to where Tim Michaels was at his campaign. Because I think that's going to be an interesting comparison to look at, of Hovde and Michaels both kind of being these wealthy, self-funding business owner types who did a lot of business outside of Wisconsin and then returned to the state to run for statewide office. And then, so I think, you know, what I'm seeing with it is pretty similar. After 2 months of the race, more than 56% of people haven't heard enough about Eric Hovde to have an opinion of him. At the equivalent time, 51% hadn't heard enough to have an opinion of Tim Michaels. His favorability rating was more even. It was 22% to 22% for that favorability rating for Tim Michaels. Hovde is underwater a little bit on that. His favorability rating there is 19% to a 24% unfavorable. So a net -5. So I guess if you're comparing the two launches, you know, for these two campaigns, I guess you would probably say that Michaels was slightly better. Running in a different race, though, right? You know, he's running in a competitive primary. Right now, Hovde has not seen any other, you know, serious Republicans in that primary for U.S. Senate. So I think we can look ahead a little bit more to the head-to-head between him and Baldwin, and we can circle back to that, too. Yeah.
Well, one of the things about Hovde that's been kind of, I mean, frustrating even from our level, you know, is that he came out with a thud. Like, it was more about, hey, I'm from Wisconsin, I'm one of you, I jump in lakes, I throw axes, and I have a mustache, I know what Wisconsin likes. And there was not a lot of policy. There's still no policy. His wife made an ad saying, my husband went to UW-Madison and he is from Wisconsin. Once again, no policy. So now he's just putting his foot in his mouth regarding voting. So it just seems like every chance he gets to have the spotlight, he fumbles the ball.
Yeah, it is. I think it seems like he's trying to run as like the quote unquote generic Republican, right? Where it's just like, oh, we just have like X business owner put into the ballot. And you know, that he was be kind of the stand in for generic Republican. And I think, you know, the comments he made on nursing homes and his terrible job trying to gaslight through an explanation for this, really not going well. One of the things that I noted, took a look at in the poll of the head to head between him and Baldwin, and also in that comparison to Michaels, is how he's doing with voters over the age of 60. You know, the Marquette poll breaks down the ages by 18 to 29, 30 to 44, 45 to 59, and then 60 and up.
60 plus.
And I thought it was really interesting to see, you know, comparing to Michaels in the favorability rating. Michaels had a much better favorability rating among voters over the age of 60. He was even with that group, 30 to 30. Hovde had his highest unfavorable number and worst net negative number of any age group with that 60 plus age group. And also, if you look at the head to head with Baldwin, too, you know, you tend to think of older voters favoring Republicans. It's actually a little bit more even in Wisconsin. The group that favors Republicans the most is that 45 to 59 age group, actually. But the 60 plus in the head-to-head with Baldwin is up double digits.
Wow.
Over
wow.
In the head-to-head. 55 to 44. The only age group that Hovde was up with was that 45 to 59 age group. And still, we have a lot of younger voters that don't have an opinion on this race just yet. You have more people undecided in that age group. But I think it's interesting to see Hovde, as he's in the news for this, the group that, you know, has the most notoriety or, you know, just had the most, the highest name recognition group that he has with is with those 60 and up voters. And he's not doing particularly well with them. Maybe saying that, you know, people in nursing homes shouldn't have their voting rights, you know, is a factor there. Who knows?
Whoa. He didn't say that. He said that if you're in a nursing home, you're going to be dead in a half a year. So,
less than a half a year.
So how could you possibly vote? I mean,
or be capable of voting.
The impending doom that is you shuffling off this mortal coil definitely keeps you from voting.
If you're just joining us, we recombobulate every Friday with Dan Schaefer from the recombobulation area. And by the way, just as a side note, Calvin, it is now on you to turn out the vote of young people everywhere. So I know you're more than willing to take that on. And
no pressure.
And own it. Yeah, exactly. No pressure. Robert from McFarland had a question for you listening in Madison on WMDX. Dan, are polls still old people with landlines?
No, it's not. The Marquette University Law School poll has modified its polling pretty significantly in recent years, and used to only conduct, you know, via landline, things like that. Only have the conversations over the phone instead of text. That has changed quite a bit in recent years. They went over a complete methodology overhaul. So if you go to these presentations and they live stream them for Marquette, you can get some of the information about how they are polling people, because a lot of times it is, you know, sending a survey to somebody by text now, or having a conversation by cell phone. It is not the way it was with just calling by landlines.
When we talk about things that are important to Wisconsinites, what is the order? It's the economy is number one, I would assume.
Yeah, the economy is number one. The number two issue, and I think I'd like to talk more about this after the break too, but the number two issue on there was immigration, and a huge difference by party in that. It was the number two issue by far among Republicans, and I think it was like close to 30% of voters said it was their top issue. 30% of Republican voters said it was their top issue. Only 1% of Democratic voters said it was their top issue. Immigration and the border being their top issue in the 2024 election. And I think there's some interesting things happening with some of the issue polling on immigration too. And I think, you know, not only is this not an issue that's really in focus among Democrats, it has become an issue that Republicans are winning on the issues with this as well. And I think there's, there are some red flags for Democrats in some of the issue polling on immigration in this poll.
I want to play this clip for you real quickly. And it's interesting that you say that, but even some hosts on Fox are admitting that this immigration crisis remains a crisis because of Donald Trump and the Republicans. Calvin, play that clip. Here's Juan Williams.
But, you know, the bigger point here is we are discussing immigration, which is a hot political issue, according to the polls, is that if, you know, former President Trump really cared about this issue, why did he block legislation that would have provided more border agents, more asylum judges, allowed the president the power to shut down the border when there was chaos or a surge? That's what, you know, was there on a bipartisan basis and was stopped.
That's Juan Williams on Fox. And we also played a clip earlier this morning, James Lankford from Oklahoma, Republican, who is the one who crafted the immigration bill and ultimately said, too, yeah, they don't want to fix it. They don't want to fix it yet. All right, we're going to continue this conversation with Dan Schaefer. We'll keep recombobulating. Stay close. You're listening to Matt Nair on Air, coming to you across the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back to Matt Nair on Air. Jane Matt Nair, Greg Mock, Calvin, coming to you from our studio in sunny downtown Waukesha. You can always join us. You can call or text at 855-75-CIVIC. Leave a comment on the live stream on Facebook, YouTube, and the platform that Elon continues to ruin. Dan Schaefer is our guest, as he is every Friday. We recombobulate with the award-winning Dan Schaefer, and we're talking about the latest numbers from the Marquette University Law School poll. And right before we went to break, Dan, we were talking about the importance of immigration in this election, at least here in Wisconsin. It's economy, and then immigration is number two.
Yeah, certainly, you know, Republicans have made this a really a salient issue in this election. And like you were talking before the break, you know, they Republicans under Donald Trump's advisement walked away from this immigration bill that would have represented a real bipartisan compromise in Congress. But I think he wants to keep it as an election issue. And you know what? It's
working.
A winning issue for Republicans right now. The polling shows this. And I think one of the things that I looked at in my breakdown was the history of the polling on a question about undocumented workers. So Marquette has polled this question about undocumented workers for many, many years in its poll, and giving the three options of saying people, undocumented workers, should have the option to stay and apply for citizenship, stay and apply to be a temporary guest worker, or would be required to leave their jobs and the country. For many, many years in this poll, huge majorities said stay and apply for citizenship would be the response. Going back from March 2016 through the 2022 midterms, more than at least 60% of the voters in the poll said that they backed a path to citizenship. That is not the case in this most recent poll. Only 49% now back a path to citizenship, and the deportation policies have risen significantly. It was only around like 15 to 20% saying that people should be forced to leave the country. Now that's 30%. And it also shows the other thing there is that the question on quote, deporting immigrants who are living in the United States illegally back to their home country. Now, more than 50% of voters in Wisconsin agree with the Trump policy on that, agree with the deportation policy. 56% in this poll said people here illegally should be deported. Only 39% opposed that statement. Obviously a big partisan split here, but this is an issue that this independents are going for the Republican position by 20%. And so what I'm saying in this, and what I said in this piece, and I didn't go deep into this issue, but I do think Democrats are not doing a good job of articulating what their position on immigration actually is. So you can say you want this compromise bill in Congress, you can say all these different things, but it seems like an issue they have ceded entirely to Republicans and letting their rhetoric kind of
dominate
the issue and dominate the issue. And I don't think they have made a case to say, hey, we back a path to citizenship. You know, under the Obama years, there was the DACA program. I just don't really know if the Biden administration and Senate and congressional Republicans have articulated what their position on immigration and what the border is. You know, you can have this compromise bill that does certain things, but I think you need more than that. You need a message on this issue to talk about a path to citizenship, talk about reframing the laws so that people who want to be here legally have a path to do so. But I think they have just ceded this issue entirely and are going to throw you these whataboutism statistics on, oh, we're actually arresting more people at the border. We're actually doing this, this, and that. I think you need a message that is going to resonate with Democratic voters. And I think being Republican light or amping up anti-immigration rhetoric, which I think, you know, you could have a takeaway from this poll saying, hey, we need to, you know, have more right-wing type policies on immigration. I think you just have to articulate what the counter position actually is.
Well, absolutely.
Democrats have not done a good enough job of it. And I think the polling bears that out.
I think because Democrats don't have a unifying idea.
Or a unified policy.
Yeah, a unified, and that is one of the biggest struggles with the Democratic Party, but the party itself, is that the GOP get in line, they say, close the border, the drugs at the border, illegals at the border.
Here's the message.
And people can get behind that. Democrats are going to sit in a room and say, well, we need to say this, but don't say this. We got to say this, but don't say this. So instead, they just, honestly, I don't think you're wrong, Dan. I think they just said, Republicans own this. We can't fight it right, at least right now. And anything they do to make changes, Republicans are saying, you're not going far enough. And some liberals are saying, you're going too far.
Well, I think it's important that we look more closely at who is hiring these illegal immigrants and bring some more focus onto them and what's going to happen to these industries if they lose this labor. Because that's from my understanding, that's a relatively big part of this problem is that there are companies, and certainly in the agriculture industry, where they rely on immigrant labor.
Well, this is, you know, Wisconsin, here in Wisconsin, America's dairy land, right? All of these dairy farmers rely on immigrant labor. And, you know, there's a great series about that at ProPublica from a reporter named Melissa Sanchez. I would encourage you to check that series out about people living and working in Wisconsin and who don't have a path to citizenship. But these are people who want to be here and want to work on these farms and want to, you know, start a career and raise a family and do all the different things that you might want to do as a citizen of the United States of America. But there's no way to do that. You know, it's not just like people not filling out their paperwork properly or anything like that. There's just not a path to citizenship.
There's no
and
process.
And being a guest worker. But it's, you know, it's really frustrating.
And we've talked about that.
Democrats have to find a new way to take ownership of this issue instead of just doing the, well, we tried to pass a bill. Well, what about this? You have to have an actual message that is going to resonate with voters here. And I think they need to do that within the next 6 months, because we're going to hear anti-immigrant rhetoric from Republicans on the campaign trail constantly.
Until they
are winning on this issue.
Yeah, until November. Dan Schaefer is with the Recombobulation Area. He joins us every Friday. I highly encourage you to subscribe to the Recombobulation Area. Thank you so very much for joining us, Dan. We'll talk to you next week. Thank you, Greg and Calvin and all our engineers. Without you, nothing works. And thank you for listening and for calling and for texting. It means absolutely everything. I hope you find some joy this weekend and you get the chance to share it. Keep it here. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.